On the Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory membership homeowners associations. Join us as we explore this relatively new world of controlled living, which includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single-family homes. Living in a common ownership development means giving up the American dream. It means giving up your constitutional rights and control over your most valuable asset, your home. Living in a homeowners association means leaving the American zone. This is On the Commons, and I am Shu Bartholomew.
This is Radio Fairfax. Welcome to our annual St. Patrick's Day edition of On the Commons, when the leprechauns come out to play and we report on the zany and wacky shenanigans that take place in the even crazier world of homeowners associations. Join Frank Short, Taylor Reardon, Matt Kafami, and of course our host, Shu Bartholomew, on the Commons as we try to find the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow.
Danny boy, the HOA has cited you. Your door bears paint in colors we've denied. The Lord blessed us with taste, but surely slighted you. Repaint your house, you louse, in shades we've specified. Our black spice tips have never been erroneous. They found you out, though clever you may be. Our threats of fines are glib and sanctimonious. Our lawyer says you'll never call our bluff, you see. But speak ye not of Gilman or the Foley case. Speak not of constitutionality. To seek injunctions might entail a loss of face, and fines enhance our revenues and treasury. To seek injunctions might cause us embarrassment. A judge might ask, what morons wrote this rule? We risk much less through this resort to harassment. Compared to judges, you're much easier to fool. Just take our word, we've high regard for all your rights. And as the proof of our sincerity, you must appear before our hand-picked court tonight to tell them why you broke our rules so shamelessly. What's that you say? Due process, proof, and evidence. Of all the nerve, we've not heard that before. Had you been innocent, we'd not have cited you. Now pay that fine, ye swine, before we fine you more.
With apologies to the entire country of Ireland for that rendition of Danny Boy. Do you think Ireland's going to be happy with us, Frank?
There's somebody who's not going to be happy with us, but...
Who's that?
Well, the folks who we intend to target tonight on our show.
Yeah, who are we going to target tonight, Frank?
Well, we've got some courtroom drama in store for you out there in radio land.
We and,
we certainly do. Samira and Maria Ferran have been on the show.
Yes, they have.
They have told the story of their case from their perspective. We're going to bring you into the courtroom, and we're going to bring you into the courtroom for some very specific readings from the transcript of one of their hearings. And the transcript is over 100 pages long. We obviously won't read the whole thing, but there are some choice selections, Shu, that...
Maybe we should have read this instead of saying.
Well, we'll get to it. We'll get to a lot of things tonight. when I was looking at the transcript and figuring out how we would present this tonight, I remembered a trip I took to Prague in the Czech Republic back in the I think it was in about 2004. I was over there to teach a group of Czech Republic Special Forces troops that had been configured as a military police unit, and they were on their way to Afghanistan. They were trying to get orders to Afghanistan, and they wanted to understand what they could expect from American forces with regard to the use of deadly force. When would our troops fire? Under what circumstances would our troops be allowed to use deadly force? They wanted to understand American law because they'd be interoperating with Americans on their left and on their right. And I asked myself, how am I going to explain this to a Special Forces Czech Republic unit that I've never met before that doesn't know anything about American law? And I was standing at our hotel, which was on a city, high up over the city of Prague. Great view. You had a castle on one side, and I looked over the city, and suddenly I found the answer to how I was going to teach this class. Everywhere you look in Prague, you saw churches. And I said, okay, there's something that we have in common. And I told the Czech Special Forces that I was going to teach them American case law, but all they had to think about was the Gospels. And just as Jesus taught in parables to teach principles of right and wrong, that's what our cases do. And that the case we're going to be reading from tonight, that's what it's about. You have a judge who went to great lengths to illustrate right and wrong, to illustrate how a homeowners association is supposed to act, where they cross the line. And when you read this case, you'll get teaching points, just like we got from the parables of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And the teaching points are here as warnings. There are two kinds of warnings that we're going to talk about tonight in, as we read from the transcripts of the case. The first one is a warning to board members. And the second one is a warning to their lawyers.
Ah, the bad guys, huh?
Well, you know, the court was pretty complimentary to the lawyers who represented the Homeowners Association. They said at several points in the transcript that the Homeowners Association had been well represented during these proceedings. But the court asked some very pointed questions, and we're going to tell you what the pointed questions were and how they were answered. And the teaching points will leap off the printed page.
Okay. Now, so we've got, I think it's 126 pages here, but we're going to kind of start in the middle, or
well, we're going to start in the middle.
Right.
For those of you who are interested in this transcript, who would like to look it up, it is case number 2011.
I'll get permission from the friends and put the whole thing up on my website.
2011-02339 from the Circuit Court of Fairfax County, Virginia, February 3rd, 2012, in a hearing before the Honorable Lorraine Nordlund, N-O-R-D-L-U-N-D. And we'll be using real names tonight from the transcript, except in one case where we will refer to an individual as Mr. X.
Okay.
So Shu will begin reading from the transcript on page 42.
Okay.
The issues that she's going to be reading about involve the hearing in which the Faran sought a declaratory judgment, they sought an injunction, and they sought attorney fees. And the allegation by the Farrans was that the board's actions in denying their request to build a deck and to replace their roof shingles was arbitrary and capricious because, among other things, the board of directors of their homeowners association did not follow either its own rules or Virginia law. And the key issue the court looked to in determining the arbitrary and capricious matter turned on the credibility of witnesses.
Yep.
So, without further ado, from page 42, here's Shu.
doing an interpretive reading on what Judge Nordland said.
Yep.
The plaintiffs are also seeking a declaratory judgment adjudging the board's denial as arbitrary and capricious. And the plaintiff sets forth 7 separate reasons, but basically those 7 reasons break down into 3 categories. The first being that the denial by the board was based upon false statements or false assertions or false beliefs. The second was that the denial was based upon consideration of improper factors. And the third was that the denial was overall without a reasonable basis. The easier analysis in this case is the second, the arbitrary and capricious basis. Therefore, I get into that, though I will first address the court's credibility determination, as they have had a significant impact on the court's findings of fact. And they've also had a significant impact on many of the court's legal determinations here, as those legal determinations you will see are couched in these credibility determinations and findings of fact. And to borrow a phrase from earlier this afternoon, I think it would be safe to say that these credibility determinations are inextricably woven through the court's ultimate decisions on 2 forms of relief sought. I will also point out that these credibility determinations are not necessarily something that I simply came to or decided just recently. After court each day, because there was such a credibility issue at the end of each day, I would sit down and review the testimony that I had heard, and I'd write down my impressions of each witness as they testified. So with that, I'll go through the witnesses in the order in which they testified for the most part. The first witness was Mr. Ferran. I found his testimony credible in light of the fact that his answers were straightforward. And most importantly, he answered questions on both direct and cross without playing games. The answers that he gave were answers to the questions asked. That's one of the things that I always look to in a credibility determination. On direct examination, I usually expect the witness to answer the questions that are asked. But when we get to cross-examination, if witnesses are fudging on the answer or they obviously don't like the answer and they try to answer a question that wasn't asked, or they start saying, well, I really don't understand the question, or they play around the question that has been asked, that tells me a lot about the credibility of that witness. I saw none of that in Mr. Ferran's testimony. Once again, he didn't play games with his answers. He answered the questions that were asked, whether it was on direct examination or cross-examination, even when he was answering questions that he obviously would have preferred not to answer. He explained his concerns with the board and their actions in a matter-of-fact manner. I did not see a great deal of emotion in his answers. And one example would be when he told the story about speaking with Miss Huffman at a social gathering, and he suggested to her that important decisions that would have impact on all members of the community needed to be put to a vote of the membership rather than decided by the board alone. And yet that suggestion was ignored. And he told the story without emotion. He just presented it. And he also answered questions on cross-examination about it. Once again, without emotion. He testified in a clean, unadorned fashion about the process that had been followed by the board with respect to his architectural request and why he had filed suit. I was impressed by this because I know that a great deal of emotion is present in this courtroom and has been present throughout this trial. And I am certain that it is nothing in comparison with the emotion that exists in that community right now. The second witness was Mr. Jeff Kenyon. I found Mr. Jeff Kenyon to be the most credible witness of all of the witnesses. He was calm. He was credible. He was matter of fact. He answered the questions as they were asked. He didn't fiddle around with the questions, and he answered them straightforward. His demeanor was one of calm credibility. His testimony was that he had drafted guideline number 18 as a proposal. He testified that the proposal had been discussed at, I can't remember whether it was the February or March board meeting, and that it had not been voted on. He testified that instead of being voted on, the members had wanted additional time to review the proposed guidelines and that the members wanted to vote on the guidelines at the subsequent meeting. He also testified that Barbara Huffman had concurred and passed the vote on the guidelines over to the next meeting. I was impressed with this, not only because of the matter in which he presented that and testified to that, but because of the fact that it was right in line and with, and it exactly reflected the board minutes. There was just no fudging. It was exactly what the board minutes said. Mr. Kenyon also testified that guideline number 18 had never been voted on and never been approved. He said that he had prepared number 18 for the purpose of giving specific standards for either roof repairs or replacement to the membership. And the reason for doing that was because up to that point, no specific standards existed, and that it was being proposed in order to give the homeowners a better chance of approval when they needed to either repair or replace their roofs. He also testified that he spoke. His testimony was that he was reflecting what he had done and said when he was the chair of the ACC at that time. He also then stated that he had approached Mr. X and said, there's a problem about guideline number 18 because it hasn't been voted on, and that Mr. X did not bring up for a vote. So Mr. Kenyon was very clear and credible. He was very clear that guideline number 18 had never been voted on, even though the membership had indicated that it was to be voted on, and even though the president of the board had indicated in the minutes that it was to be voted on at a subsequent meeting. Mr. Kenyon also testified that although the ordinary process for review for architectural requests would be to go to the ACC to decide, that if there were unusual situations, such as when a member of the ACC or a member of the board was making a request, the more appropriate avenue was to submit it directly to the board. So he did indicate that although the ordinary process was to go to the ACC, that there were other processes that were put in place under unusual circumstances. I found him credible. He gave testimony that was favorable to both sides on that issue.
So that's a judge explaining how she judges the credibility of witnesses who appear before her, and that's how the judge assessed the credibility of two important witnesses in the case. Now we'll skip forward to page 57 of the transcript, and we'll see how the judge assessed the credibility of another witness in the case, Mr. X. Mr. X was the president of the Homeowners Association, and she will now read the judge's assessment of Mr. X's credibility.
Mr. X, his testimony was not so much unbelievable as it was astounding in his total lack of understanding as to what his legal obligations as president were or what procedures needed to be followed in accordance with the declarations, in accordance with Virginia Code, and in accordance with his position as the president representing the membership, as opposed to his own personal views. My problem with his credibility began just as he began to testify. He testified that he didn't know what the ACC's decision was when he took the Ferrand's request over to the board. Elsa made a note at the time that Mr. X has what I call tell, in that he was fine. His complexion was fine until he was asked that question. The moment he was asked that question, he said, no, I didn't know what the decision was. And he turned bright red and began to sweat. I noticed these things. I made note of it in my notes. Then when he was asked why he had voted against the roof request, he testified because it had to be concrete. I made a note of the fact that Mr. Blanchard was out of the room at the time that he testified to this, because I was rather shocked at that. The reason is because his testimony that the reason he voted against it was because the tiles had to be concrete was A, contrary to the decision that was reflected in the minutes. It was contrary to the April 2009 minutes, where he wrote in his own paragraph that almost any product would likely be approved. So he was writing in his paragraph that any product would likely be approved, but, quote, I'm denying the Ferrand's request because it has to be concrete, end of quote. I had a problem with that. During his testimony, he admitted, one, that he had ignored Mr. Kenyon's assertion that there was a problem with the guideline 18 in that it had not been approved or voted on by the board or the membership. He ignored this assertion and unilaterally decided to adopt guideline 18 and just wrote a paragraph explaining why he had adopted it, essentially saying to the membership, quote, it doesn't matter that the membership voted to have a vote. It doesn't matter that the prior board president said it has to go to the membership to a subsequent meeting, end of quote. He didn't attend that meeting. Apparently, he didn't read the minutes. And so the membership didn't get to vote on it. The board didn't get to vote on it. The only person who had any decision in that was the president. I had a problem with that testimony, and the reason I had a problem with it was because Mr. X ignored the clear mandate of both the members as well as the board vote from a previous board meeting. I also found that he took the Ferrand's decision away from the ACC when the ACC was going to approve the request and then set up the July meeting. Of course, the real problem was the fact that Mr. X did not understand the ramifications of failing to give notice of the board meeting to the membership and not having the minutes prepared and not having those minutes distributed. He didn't even realize that this constituted a secret meeting. In fact, on cross-examination, when asked if there had ever been a secret meeting, he absolutely denied it. And yet, when confronted with the fact that there was no notice of a July meeting, no minutes prepared for distribution, and no minutes actually distributed, all of a sudden he, I doubt I've ever seen anybody turn as red as he did in this courtroom, he seemed to be gulping for air. I was concerned for his health, and that's one of the reasons why I said we need to have a recess. It was apparent that there had been this thunderbolt of realization on his part as to what it was that he had done. And what that told me was that all of these things were within his knowledge, but not within his realization. And it also told me that it was the reason why it hadn't been discovered until his actual testimony at the trial. Because while he knew all of these things, when asked if there had ever been any secret meetings, he just didn't even realize that a secret meeting such as that was a secret meeting.
or that it was in violation of the code, or that he couldn't just simply adopt a guideline where the membership had voted to vote on it, or that the board had voted to vote on it, and that as president, he didn't have that authority. He was just totally ignorant of his responsibilities, or of his legal responsibilities, or even his responsibilities as a fellow member of this community. And for this reason, I found it was not merely a mistake, it was pure arrogance and an unwillingness to do things properly. And by the book, he made his own rules. And the entire community has to suffer because of it. These are my findings to the testimony and the facts and the credibility of the witnesses. And it's necessary for me to go through that because each and every one of these findings is intricately involved in every decision that follows. So I wanted to put on the record why I made these decisions and how it was completely couched in the credibility findings that I have made in this case. During the time that I have observed the witnesses and made my notes each day after court, and I kept track of these, I have 23 pages of notes that I took, extensive notes, not wanting to rely upon a court reporter because I realized there was a great deal of emotion tied up in this, and there was a great deal of confusion as to what is the responsibility of the board, and that much was apparent to us.
So, credibility of witnesses, duties of board members, duties of board presidents. We're now going to talk about how the court handled the fact that the law firm representing the Homeowners Association claimed to be unaware of the actions of Mr. X, or had possibly not questioned Mr. X to establish before we got to court what Mr. X had done, what Mr. X knew, what Mr. X's version of the facts were, so that the Homeowners Association could have avoided the surprise and the disastrous, from the perspective of the Homeowners Association, testimony of Mr. X. And as we read this portion of the transcript, Hsu will read the lines of Judge Nordland, and I will read the lines of the attorney for the Homeowners Association.
You mean we're going to do some acting here?
We're going to do some further courtroom drama. Oh. And this, we're now on page 105 of the transcript.
Gosh, that was quick. You made me do all the work this week, this time. All right. Let me just ask you this.
Sure.
Mr. X was always at your disposal.
Yes.
You could have asked him any time. You could have spoken with him. Wasn't he deposed?
In the prior lawsuit, yes, Your Honor.
And during that deposition, he was being deposed about this meeting and all. Why was it not discovered that no notice was ever sent about that meeting? Why weren't there questions asked when you saw written notes from that meeting? I mean, weren't questions asked about that?
During that first deposition, Your Honor, my firm did not represent the OBTOA.
Okay.
The issue of notice was not...
Wait a minute. During your representation, you always knew you could talk to him about this. I mean, didn't you ask him, tell me exactly what you did and go through it all? I mean, wouldn't there have been a red flag? Honestly, wouldn't there have been a red flag when you saw these minutes saying that there was going to be a vote and there was no vote? And he just issues this. I mean, it was a red flag to me the minute I saw it. And representing him, I would imagine there would have to be a red flag to you that you would just sit down with him. Okay, now you were the president during the time that Guideline 18 was supposedly being adopted. Go through everything that happened with Guideline 18, because we're going to have to prove everything about Guideline 18. Let's sit down about everything that happened in that denial. Go through every step of it, and let's talk about it, because we're going to have to prove what happened in that meeting and how it happened and when it happened and that it was all done by the book. I mean, you know these things are going to have to be presented.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you didn't go through that with him prior to, or what was it, that he lied to you all? I don't know that there's even an appropriate question for me, because I don't want to invade the province between you and your clients. But that's the thing that boggles my mind. I mean, this man got up there and blew the case apart. And you had every opportunity to discuss this with him before we came here, after hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Your Honor, there are several points. I hesitate, and it's not my intent in any way to argue the merits of Your Honor's decision, because I understand that your decision has been rendered, and I don't want to revisit that.
I wasn't even saying that I didn't find him incredible. I'm just reciting what he said.
Right. Your Honor, the issue of notice was never raised. We went through, you know, without getting into any kind of attorney-client privilege. You and I have different conclusions as to whether or not Mr. X was telling the truth or his credibility.
I said it wasn't a matter of credibility. It was listening to what he said and not even being able to believe that somebody could be that ignorant of the law.
I understand, Your Honor.
I mean, really? Maybe there needs to be a law that says before you can be president, you have to read the rules, for goodness sakes. But my goodness, seriously, a simple meeting with that man would have revealed all of the things that he did wrong that led to the situation. That could have been so easily resolved.
Your Honor, we did not get into this case until 2 years afterwards.
That doesn't make any difference. You were in this case during preparation for trial when so much money was spent during preparation for trial. A simple meeting with that man was all that was needed.
And with that, we will mercifully stop.
I was that bad, Frank.
Well, that was page 109, and the transcript went on for
126.
You know, another dozen or so pages. But you get the gist of it, don't you?
If you're an attorney representing associations, get your act together. You know,
you got to talk to your client. And if you don't talk to your client and your case blows up, don't complain to the judge.
Maybe you don't like your client.
Well, you know, you don't have to like him. You just have to represent him.
You just have to represent him.
But you have to talk to him.
What a concept. Actually talking to your client?
Well, in our experience, Shu, as members of our association, when you and I finally got elected to the board and the real fun began, we got copies of correspondence with the association's lawyer that had never seen the light of day.
Yes.
And we found out what the association's lawyer had been telling people on the very issue of, finding people. And the association had asked, well, you know, we've got this Gilman case in Virginia from the Supreme Court that talks about fines being unconstitutional. What do you think? And remember what the lawyer said? Our association lawyer told the association, well, if you want to keep finding people, then – That's what you should do, and if you get challenged on that point, then you can make a decision based on what you? The economics of the litigation. So what we see is right out of Danny Boy, our lawyer says, you'll never call our bluff, you see?
Well, you know, homeowners have been calling their bluff a lot lately. And
it's about time.
It's about time. Well, interesting, you're talking about hidden opinions, because last week I interviewed Pat Batt and Rudy Grum, and they're with the Manchester Oaks. And I said, the facts in your case sound very similar to Sully Station. Why did you have to go through and retry this case? Well, apparently when they became aware of Sully Station, they actually took the case to the association, the board, and said, look, we have the same situation here, and here's what the court said in Sully Station. So they paid for a legal opinion. The legal opinion was, of course, you know, it was not made available to the homeowners. And the board went ahead and just mumbled and did whatever they wanted to do. Now, our friends Pat and Rudy get on the board, and guess what? Now they have access to all the files of the association, and there's that opinion by the attorney that says, you can't do that! And, of course, they went ahead and did it. So, you know, and that association also has filed bankruptcy.
Yep.
Just like the Ferrans.
Just like the Ferrans. You know,
that's one way of getting rid of them,
well,
Frank.
Yeah. There was an email the other day from Velvet Jones Esquire, from the, you know, he was admitted in the last class of the Junior College of CAI Lawyers. And Velvet was wondering whether he could buy that that land at Old Belhaven that the association's got to sell, but he's torn on what he'll do with it if he can buy it. One option is a miniature golf course, but he thinks there may be more money in a massage parlor if he can just get one of those. So, you know, the residents at Old Belhaven are kind of old and decrepit, and a massage parlor would probably just, you know, fit right in with the lifestyle over there.
Hey, a massage parlor might not be such a bad thing in an HOA. You know, now you're getting to the crux of the matter. Now we've got something of value to give to these people. So what else is on the agenda, Frank? We've still got quite a lot of time.
Well, let's see. Usually we spend the St. Patrick's Day show talking about the adventures down in Richmond with our Virginia legislature. And the subject of House Bill 2257 was rule enforcement. And what House Bill 2257 would have done, it would have changed the Property Owners Association Act, Section 55.513, which is adoption and enforcement of rules, and it would have empowered homeowners associations, and only homeowners associations, to bring a suit in district court, basically to seek injunctive relief. Now, we had that same proposal come up a few years ago.
I was going to say, that's not new.
Yeah, and what we didn't like about it when it came up, and we weren't able, unfortunately, to stop it, but what we didn't like about it was only the association could bring this action in district court. They could bring the action against the homeowner, but if the homeowner believed that the association was violating the governing documents, the homeowner had no relief. He had to go to circuit court, which is much more expensive, and you almost always need an attorney. And the question we asked was, why isn't what's sauce for the goose sauce for the gander? And unfortunately, we did not prevail in that. But the good news is that Delegate Lemunyan's bill is dead. another bill we weren't so lucky. This was House Bill 1595, and this did pass. And this is on the issue of late fees. Now, late fees have been a moneymaker for associations. They were a moneymaker for our association for years until we got on the board and we pointed out that this rule you've adopted about a late fee is in violation of the declaration, because the declaration says that the remedy of the association, if an assessment isn't paid on time, is to charge interest at 6% per annum, which isn't bad these days. You know, what are you making on your bank CDs these days, Hughes, or your, you know, passbook savings? You're not making 6% these days, are you?
No, not 6%.
And our association had been charging $25 as a late fee, which was grossly in excess of what 6% per annum would have been.
They were charging the 6% as well.
Yeah, but who's counting? So this piece of legislation says, except to the extent that the declaration or any rules or regulations promulgated pursuant thereto provides otherwise. And that's going to be key. The board may impose a late fee for any assessment or installment thereof that is not paid within 60 days of the due date for payment of such assessment, except to the extent that the declaration provides otherwise, no such late fee shall exceed the penalty provided in Section 8.1-3915. Now, if you have an association that has a declaration that says, here's the remedy of the association, I would submit to you that your declaration provides otherwise. When it says, here's the remedy, well, here's the remedy. And if you want to change that remedy for the association, then you go back and change the declaration. And that can be lots of fun, can't it, Sue?
Oh, yeah. That is a lot of fun.
Most homeowners associations require a supermajority.
And they should. They're trying to change that to a simple majority, and I don't think that's fair.
Well, what they passed a few years ago was that unless your declaration provides otherwise, the majority that you need is two-thirds. And not even the legislature would go any lower than that. But I think most of the homeowners association built, when ours was built, you require 75%.
Yeah, I think it should be 100%.
Yeah, well, there's a lot to be said for, changing a contract, a very important contract about the place where you live, where, folks who don't like you could just outvote you and change the declaration to their advantage or your disadvantage. That is, as they say in the law, bad.
They say that in the law, do they?
They do. I think Judge Nordland said it someplace.
Did I read that? Missed it. That's one of the pages we didn't read, right?
Yep. So.
Basically, it's been a very quiet legislative year this year.
Yeah, it has been quiet. There was a piece of legislation about home businesses that would have improved the rights of homeowners to set up a business out of their home. And it would have given the association rights to limit the activity incident to that business that would have affected traffic in the neighborhood or things like that. And that didn't pass. So
the thing is, some of these stupid bills will be back again next year.
Oh, they certainly will.
Because you know where they're coming from, right?
I don't think there's any doubt about it. So we're also continuing to track developments in Las Vegas, where a whole panoply of characters has been indicted for a scheme that involved repairs to condominiums. And the scam seems to have been that the insiders on the scam, the people who are going to make the most money, it's alleged, they'd go out and hire individuals, and those individuals would purchase, sometimes with various types of assistance from the insiders, they'd purchase a condominium unit. Then they would get on the condominium board of directors. And once they were on the condominium board of directors, they would suddenly become very interested in construction defect litigation. And, well, guess what? We already have a tailor-made law firm to represent you in going after your builder for construction defects. And we also have a construction company that'll come in and correct all those defects for you. All you have to, and we're all set up to do this, and come one, come all, and hire us. And this has been under investigation first by the U.S. Attorney's Office in Las Vegas, and then, in a very unusual move, attorneys from the Department of Justice, Maine Justice, came in and took over those proceedings. As all this is going on, we have two, count them, two lawyers whose names were associated with this, dead.
Ensure and Kwan.
Right. And both by what's reported to have been suicide, one a drug overdose in the bathtub and the other by hanging. Interestingly, the attorney who supposedly hanged himself had just gotten out of the hospital where he'd been treated for a bad beating that I guess he inflicted on himself.
Yeah, he'd broken both his kneecaps.
Yeah.
Was found, you know, wandering around naked in his neighborhood.
Well, that probably violated a covenant or two.
You think?
That might have been too much information for this audience. Not exactly.
Find him. Oops, he's dead. Correct.
Yep. So we're continuing to watch that. The Las Vegas papers have done a very good job in reporting it. And frankly, Shu, even though we had the Ferran case reported on the first page of the Washington Post, the Sunday Post, a week or so ago, I was disappointed that the case was kind of presented as, well, this is just a personality clash.
Yeah,
another one of what CAI would call isolated incidents. And all of our boards are, you know, so good. And I don't think that the Washington Post gets it. And if you're out there and you're a reporter and you start digging into this and you start looking at the big picture and you start looking at trade associations and who's in them and who they really speak for and what their real agenda is, there could be a Pulitzer Prize in it. And I don't think I'm exaggerating. This is a big enough issue. There's enough Americans who live in these associations who are being governed by them every day, and they wield influence in the state legislatures, not in Virginia, not only in Virginia, but across the country, vastly disproportionate to the membership in the trade association.
We have a budding journalist in the studio with us today, so maybe we can groom our budding journalists be that Pulitzer Prize winning.
We can certainly point some journalists in the right direction. Because, I mean, there's enough stuff in our files to keep a journalist going for years. And the journalists would have a lot of fun while they're doing it.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, I wish that there'd been a journalist in the courtroom during the Ferran hearing. I wish that the journalist who wrote the story in the Washington Post had taken the time to read the transcript that we just read. Because it might have influenced how that story was reported.
Yeah, they might have actually got the St. Patrick's Day team on that and be singing Danny Boy to them.
That's right. If you're out there and you're interested, you probably want to take a close look at who's on the Virginia Housing Commission. And who they represent, and then the Common Interest Communities Board is an even bigger joke. And you won't have to dig too hard to find the link between the Common Interest Community Board and the Ferran case.
That's true. That's true. There are some other connections I'll have to tell you about when we're not on the air.
Yep.
I'll save that for the Pulitzer Prize winning journalist.
That's right. You know, these people are appointed by the governor, and I don't think that the governor would have to look too hard to find, you know, more people who actually live in community associations and who are interested in protecting the homeowners as consumers to serve on that board. And the fact that we have a requirement that two of the people on the board out of, I think it's 11 now, two of them actually have to live in community associations.
Yeah, do you remember how hard we had to fight to get that?
Oh, yeah.
They said, well, where are you going to find people who live in associations? Gee whiz, just, you know, take a handful of rocks and just throw it up in the air. You're likely to hit one with every rock will hit a homeowner.
Yep.
In an association. So Vegas, I want to go back to that for just a second, because what's going on in Vegas, they don't anticipate getting anything done for yet another year. They're still investigating, and this has been going on for how many years, Frank?
Well, I think it's been going on for 3 or 4 years. As I recall, one of the first stories about it was a retired police officer committed suicide.
Yeah.
And, you know, that one sounded kind of fishy to me, that it was, you know, Vince Foster-like.
Mm-hmm.
in some ways as I read the news reports. And there seems to have been some connection with either retired police, former police, with this, with the inside ring, who was.
They've been involved. In fact, a police officer was Nancy Kwan's boyfriend, mm-hmm. and he was at some point accused of trying to poison her to get her money.
Yeah.
So there's all kinds of dirty dealings going on. But you know what, Frank? They're uncovering that in Las Vegas, but that's going on across the country. We have similar things going on, maybe not quite to the same scope.
No, but the charges that are being brought in Las Vegas are charges that, you know, you and I have talked about and being used in associations right around here. If the right people get interested, because we have pretty strong statutes on mail fraud.
Yep.
And when you use the U.S. mails to advance a criminal enterprise, you expose yourself to some very interesting possibilities for federal prosecutions. And, you know, so I would suggest to homeowners associations, be very careful what kind of demands you put in the mail. And be very careful that the things you demand are backed up by your governing documents.
You might be answering some of these questions.
If you have any doubts, you might want to talk to your association attorney and actually tell him what you're thinking, so that he doesn't, you know, put you on the witness stand and have you implode like Mr. X.
We're out of time.
All right.
Our annual St. Patrick's Day show has come to an end, and I want to thank our leprechauns, Frank Short, Taylor Reardon, Matt Kafami, and I'm Sue Bartholomew. Have fun. Find that pot of gold at the end of the rainbow.
Please check out our website at onthecommons.us. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect. All my neighbors felt the same.
Then along came death by CCRs. Life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to Justice for HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Well, we're not afraid or stupid, all your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone, united we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine, and enjoy those precious golden years, stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.